Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to open the show by opening the phones at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Later this hour, we'll learn about research into the Cyrex wood wasp, an invasive species that has made it to North America from its homeland in Spain. We'll get some tips on hunter safety as the wild turkey season begins. Colin Flanders of 7 Days will share info on the idea of the state paying parent caregivers of adults with disabilities. And then we meet someone who is probably out on Mount Mansfield or Camel's Hump right now. He's reached the summit of those two mountains nearly 2,000 times. But first to the phones, we can discuss your favorite topics. We can squeeze in some poetry as we close in on the end of National Poetry Month. So feel free to share a fave. We had a great question put to me yesterday about the use of campaign dollars that I was going to ask Bob Ney about this morning, but he's been taken hostage by CNN all morning. So I'll do my best to answer that question with the research that I've done. And let's see, beautiful snow on the mountains. Does that inspire you at this time of year? I still love seeing the beautiful white on the mountains at this time. Saw it on the way in. Also saw a sign popped up a few weeks ago, a little, I'm going to call it a wee billboard that someone snuck that you can see from Route 2 and I-89 in Bolton Flats that has the words, "Putin is a coward." Anybody else see that? All right. Phones are open. You can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Again, the email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And batting leadoff this morning, we're going to head to South Woodbury and speak with Bill. Good morning, Bill.
Howdy.
How you doing?
Oh, not bad for a young fella.
Attaboy.
Well, I got a good one for you to peruse here.
All right.
Everybody always complains about the condition of Route 14. Well, you know, we've got all the garbage going up to Coventry.
Yep.
And, well, the leachate, and a lot of people have been complaining about the fact that the leachate from that landfill comes down and gets deposited into the Montpelier wastewater plant.
Correct.
Because, of course, Newport couldn't handle it, and it would just go into Memphremagog and,
right.
Well, be a mess.
Yep.
Well, I've been trucking, well, I'm retired, but I was trucking for 35 years. I worked in Florida for many a year. And down there in Okeechobee, north of the lake,
mm-hmm.
is a landfill. Now, we all know that Florida's pretty flat, and when you start to approach it from a long distance away, you see a bump, and then it gets bigger and bigger. It's now well over 10 stories tall. It covers probably bigger than the size of Burlington, but
right.
There's nothing there. So anyway, they have their own pit that the leachate goes into. Of course, it's an all-lined landfill.
Yep.
It comes down, and they have a little plant there, and they burn off the water, put the sludge back into a tanker, and drive it up to the top of the landfill, because there's really, I mean, where are you going to take the sludge?
Right.
So they just drive it back up to the top of the landfill, and it just, you know, recycles it. Essentially, that's really all you need to do is burn the water off of it and then just put it back on top. There's no place to take it that's safe.
Right.
So I don't understand us being supposedly a green state, how many hundreds of thousands of gallons of diesel that these trucks use
yeah.
every year. They run 24/7. And they go from Coventry to Montpelier all the time, day and night.
Right.
And I don't know why that they don't have a plant like that up there. The one in Okeechobee, it wasn't very big. It just was a big boil as it boiled off the water.
So expense isn't really too outrageous is what you're saying. Because that,
yeah.
that would be my first thought. Can we afford something like this?
Well, yeah, considering you've got to pay the truck drivers, you've got the diesel, you've got the trucks.
And they're tearing up for Route 14.
Yeah, and then there's another little tiny thing that nobody really should, that nobody ever realizes. These trucks, well, there are some owner-operators that haul and they are registered with their plates in Vermont. But the MBI trucks that go up and down with the garbage and quite a few of the leachate trucks are registered in Illinois. So, yes, we do get an apportioned amount of money from that registration, but not nearly enough to help pay for the roads that they, you know, tear up.
Yeah. And Bill, you know, Bill's bringing up a great point because this is really, in effect, the only usable or serviceable landfill in the state up in Coventry. So everything is being shipped up there from the state. I think there's a small one maybe in Addison County is, you know, a few places where a little bit is removed from the waste stream that heads to Coventry. But that is really where it's all heading, and the leachate then heads. Does it go to the sewage plant in Montpelier? Is that the basic idea then, Bill?
Yep, they bring the tanker down there and they just back in. There's a little pad there and they just back right in and hook up and ploop, it goes in there. Now, when the landfill over to Moortown was around,
yep,
they would take their leachate and go onto the back of Main Street and Barry, right in front of the City Department of Public Works there, and they just park right in the middle of the street and open up a manhole, put the tube right down, and dump it right in there.
Yikes.
And that would go to the Barry sewer treatment plant.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah, so.
Which eventually, you know, it all goes into the Winooski.
Right. Yeah, after but it's processed.
I still think they have to take leachate out of that landfill, even though it's been closed for many years. But that's the last time I knew that's what they do. They just drive on the back street there and pop it open.
All right. So if we boil off the water, we could certainly reduce a lot of the trucking, hauling it all the way down to Montpelier.
And millions being saved. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I'm voting for you for governor. You know, no one's declared yet, Bill. but this is great homework for me, and I'll see what I can learn about this.
Well, good. I guess I figured I'd put a bug in your ear.
I like it. Thanks, Bill.
Have fun.
All right. Take care. All right. Off we go now to, we head to the Duke of Newbury. Fred, good morning.
Morning. Hey, guess what? The Constitution of the United States should be one of the wonders of the world.
Ah, that's what I was going to guess.
yeah, right. You're pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, it's been around for over 200 years. We've only had 27 amendments to the Constitution. It's unbelievable.
That is.
We're the oldest government in the world.
That's
right down to it.
You know, we're around almost 250 years, you know, so think about, but the Constitution was written when, Fred? A little later.
The Constitution, yeah, it was written, but it was ratified by New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And that makes New Hampshire unbelievably interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, it does. When you think of the forward thinking, again, in the late 1700s to create a democracy, which was probably unlike just about any in the world at the time, to write a constitution that has held up for almost 250 years with, as you said, less than 30 amendments to it. It's pretty incredible. And I'm glad that is a great civics lesson, Fred, for us to all look at. We can have our opinions. We can disagree on a lot of things, but think about, you know, what those documents of the time, you know, what it took to write them with such vision that they could hold up for well over two centuries.
And guess what?
Go ahead.
Vermont was the first state.
The first state?
That's right. You know, Vermont was the first state.
Not the 14th.
Delaware wasn't the first. No, it was the first state because Vermont wasn't one of the colonies.
Right.
So the United Colonies declared themselves the United States on the 4th of July, and then the Constitution had to be ratified. It was ratified, I think, in 1789 by New Hampshire. And guess what? Vermont was called the Republic of Vermont.
It was.
Joined the United States. And Vermont is the first state. Delaware isn't. It was the first colony to ratify the Constitution.
Oh.
And those historians are driving me nuts.
Ah, I love it, Fred. All right, great history points this morning. Thanks for that. Yeah, the other were 13 original colonies. We became then the first state to join the United States. Kind of like that. All right, phones are open, and we can talk poetry, Ukraine, invasive species, election cash, leachate. What an interesting topic. The Constitution, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Don't forget, I'll be at the Cabot Creamery Annex. It's the Farmer's Store, the Cabot Farmer's Store on Route 100 for tomorrow's show. And they'll be opening at 9 just for us and, of course, for early arriving cheese fans. So you can come in and shop early tomorrow and see the show unfold. And the phones, again, open to share your thoughts. And let's head over to Shelburne, talk to our friend Ted. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning. Spring is coming, maybe in some cases. Well, in Shelburne, spring is more here than some.
Yeah.
But speaking of things that were not on your list, human nutrition is a good one. Mm-hmm. Homeschooling might be relevant. It's the time for some green leafy vegetables called dandelion greens. And they've never been on a truck, and they're affordable, and they're highly nutritious. And I like to cut them a little below the ground, so I have a bit of the root and the crown as a part of my green leafy vegetable. And I was thinking, well, Cabot would have been a good place, but the season was wrong. Alan LePage is kind of a philosopher gardener, I think, in Plainfield. I used to be able to hear him on WGDR through a little slot somewhere near Camel's Hump in my Charlotte Hillside when I, when I was tending my garlic in a certain couple hundred square feet. I could get broadcast from there. So dandelion greens and other things, of course, everybody thinks about fiddleheads and the, sort of the touristy items, but human nutrition is relevant and can be found not at a food bank or grocery store even, and it's sort of educational. So there is that.
Well, tell us a little bit more about dandelion greens. I've always had the impression that they're kind of like a bit of a bitter green. Am I right?
Well, you know, it might be my taste buds, but
sure.
Especially this time of year, as soon as that little bud in the center begins to soften up and think about getting a stem under it to become other things in its cycle.
Right.
I just don't get the bitter, and I even can either add something to or, you know, drink the small amount of water that they've been boiled in for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's personal taste, I think. And also, if you just grab a leaf later in the year or something, it will be bitter.
Yeah.
But and I think the nutrition would be good because, I mean, I know I've heard probably somebody sitting in one of those chairs at your place had somebody in and who had degrees and tenure and so on, but she just said, well, yeah, somebody at Shelburne Farms or Shelburne Shelburne Farms, you know, served me a dandelion. This word search is difficult.
Oh, okay. And, some
kind of party food. But it's really good human nutrition.
Sure.
It's traditional. And find something about your grandmothers or great-grandmothers and add it to the way of getting fed, because people are having trouble with budgets and nutrition and pesticides and lots of things.
What I love, Ted, is people come out to their front lawns and see, you know, dandelions and go a little crazy. And you see dandelions in your front yard and you go a little crazy because you're thinking, ooh,
well,
salad.
It's my spring tonic. It's my spring tonic, kind of. I'm just craving something out of the garden.
Sure.
That is absolutely out of the garden, but it's good food. And there's, geez, there's a garlic chive which spreads like crazy. And it lasts, its season is much, much, much longer than the tubular chives with yep. the blossoms and so on. Anyhow, I wonder if Alan LePage, you know, is someone who's very down to earth, and I'm not sure what his state of. He actually used to sell the inline greens at the Montpelier Farmers Market, which probably is starting May 8th.
Right.
Because it always used to be the week preceding my obligation to be at the Burlington Farmers Market, and I went over there at least once and saw that he was selling dandelion greens. And if he could be findable and if he is willing to talk,
yep.
because the book writers and tourist amusers and so on are different than other food people sometimes.
Right.
So that's, you know, I guess, well also if you get somebody who's looking at every aspect of our troubled culture, sorry to make this switch, but.
It's all right, Ted. You're in charge in open phones, so. I can see the link.
Study yeah. carefully and research where this is coming from, because we have, you know, young women being pursued and groomed and so forth, and we have people shooting guns in the wrong places at the wrong time and doing. There are a whole number of sociological issues that have gone not the right direction.
Yeah.
So it would be great to study that whole thing and see where it's coming from in our culture and try to do something about it. I think I've had enough of your show. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Ted. Always great hearing
from you. Find the wild foods and their nutritional value. Thank you.
You got it. That's great. I have got to find out who can talk to us about dandelion greens. All right. I've got a few minutes. I'm going to try to answer a question that was brought up yesterday about if I'm going to use Bob Ney as an example, who's a congressman. I made a contribution to Bob Ney when he was running for Congress, and he had a leftover war chest. That money then he used as he decides he now wants to run for Senate. Well, I supported him for Congress. I didn't support him for Senate. Can I get my grand back? You know, how can he use that? So here are permissible uses. The contribution can be used that you give to anybody running. They can use it for donations to charities as long as the candidate does not receive any compensation from the organizations before it is spent and the donation is not used by the charity to benefit the candidate. A donation of a maximum of $2,000 to another federal candidate and donations to state or local candidates, so they can give to other candidates up to a limit. Gift donations of nominal value on special occasions to anyone besides the candidate's family. Unlimited transfers to a local, state, or national political party committee. I did mention that, like the Democratic or Republican national committees. All right, I'm going to keep this, and we'll probably have time to talk about that next week. But let's try to get one more call in. We've got our friend in Royalton, Harry, calling us this morning. Harry, we've got a couple minutes. What's going on?
For one thing, I'd like to tell you, if they'd have found you for human interest stories, Vermont Life would still be in business.
Oh, thank you.
You do a great job.
Thank you, Harry.
Are you going to get Peter Welch on?
I just had him on.
Yeah, I know, but he only wanted to deal with Ukraine. I think there's other questions if he's running for Senate.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Harry, so, you know, this is that delicate balance, right, when, you know, you don't want to give a candidate who is in office – the opportunity
too
if
much
you can.
Time.
Yeah. And so, that's your point is well taken. But, the interview I had the other day was his work currently in Congress, and that was the trip to, Eastern Europe. And that's why I focused it on that and did not ask any campaign questions at this time.
Yeah.
So, because there will be time for that when we get all the other candidates on. But, so he will be back as a senatorial, okay. as a candidate for Senate, and I appreciate that you asked that, Harry. Thanks.
Okay, then.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right, you take care. I like that.
I could have kept Vermont life alive. I do love the human interest stories in Vermont and finding them next week. I'm going to talk to a violin maker in Vermont, a banjo maker in Vermont. Later today, we're going to hear from Mark Kelly, who has reached the summit of Camel's Hump and Mount Mansfield around a couple thousand times. We do have a lot of interesting people and individuals, but we will be lining up candidates to talk about their candidacy as the campaign season really gets going. We probably will wait till the other side of the legislative session. All right, Danny, bottle up the open phones for the week. We're going to take a break for CBS News Update and then be back to meet the Cyrex Wood Wasp. And coming up today at 2:07, Sox and Jays wrap up their series. First pitch from the Rogers Center on WDEV is 3:07. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Ooh, invasive species. Can't they just leave us alone? Why are they here in the first place? And what makes them invasive anyway? Joining us now, and not to get too cheeky, is a flora to educate us about some fauna. We're going to learn about the research recently conducted on the Cyrex wood wasp. Flora Krivec-Tetley is a postdoctoral researcher and ecology, evolution, environment, and society lecturer at Dartmouth College. Flora, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Flora about the Cyrex or invasive species in general, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Flora, please give us a nice introduction to the Cyrex wood wasp and where it normally calls home.
Yeah, sure. So Cyrex wood wasp is a large black and orange member of the Cericid family. So that's the horntail family of wood wasps. They're native to much of Eurasia and northern Africa. We work with populations in northern Spain. And Cericids are also called wood wasps because they feed on the wood or the xylem of trees. The Cyrex wood wasp mainly attacks pine trees, and they're really unique in this family in their ability to kill healthy trees, whereas most wood wasps mainly scavenge in dead and dying trees. These guys can actually kill healthy trees when their populations get large enough.
Mm. We don't like that. In their native area, does the Cyrex do a lot of destruction to flora and fauna there?
So in the native range, they're actually considered a scavenger. You know, there's no special management done in pine forests. And until they became invasive in other parts of the world, they were somewhat ignored in their native range. So in Spain, where we work, populations seem to be somewhat limited by natural enemies. And also in some places, potentially just a lack of resource availability.
What do you find particularly interesting about the Cyrex?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, I mentioned a moment ago that Cyrex is really unique in its ability to kill healthy trees. And actually, I thought I might describe a little bit about their life cycle to give you some context for why they're a pretty fascinating animal.
Good.
That sound good? Okay. So, like I mentioned before, these wasps attack pine trees. So if you imagine their flight season is in the summer season, imagine a female wasp showing up in a pine forest, and she's looking for two things there. She's looking for a mate, so a male wasp, and she's also looking for a good host tree. So if she finds a mate, she will have fertilized eggs. If she doesn't, she can actually still produce offspring, but they'll all be males. And then she looks for a suitable pine tree. And if she finds a pine tree, she'll drill her ovipositor in under the bark and into the phloem. So that layer right under the bark. And she'll deposit three things in there. So one is her eggs. And they lay up to three or four eggs potentially in one oviposition site. And she also carries fungi in these specialized organs. And she puts those in with the eggs, and they have to get established in the tree and grow in the woods for the larvae to be able to develop there. Hmm. And then there's a third thing that she puts in the same hole, which is venom. And that weakens the tree, helps the fungi get established, and helps her larvae get established. So if that whole process all goes well, her larvae will hatch, they'll tunnel into the wood and grow. And they'll spend the whole next year eating wood inside the tree that's been sort of pre-digested by those fungi. And then generally, yeah, they'll overwinter and then pupate near the surface and emerge as adults in the next, most of them in the next summer. But there are two things that can interrupt that cycle. And one of these is there are parasitoid wasps that will lay their eggs on Cyrex eggs or larvae. So they're actually attracted to the same sites where a Cyrex female laid her eggs. And if they get in there and lay their eggs, those eggs will hatch and they'll actually enter and then consume the Cyrex larvae. So you'll get a parasitoid emerging instead of another Cyrex wood wasp.
Wow.
And then the second thing that can interrupt that cycle, I know this is kind of long, but this is one of the things most fascinating to me, is that there's a parasitic nematode that these females can carry. And so if a female has nematodes, they live inside her body, she will deposit those inside a tree along with her eggs and her fungus and her venom. And those nematodes feed on the same fungi that Cyrex larvae do. And then when the larvae are large enough, the nematodes will penetrate the body of the larva. They migrate to the gonad area. And if it's a female wood wasp, they actually will enter the eggs in some cases and then sterilize her. So both those parasitic nematodes and the parasitoid wasps have been used as a biological control in parts of the world where Cyrex is an invasive problem.
Well, are we having an invasive problem in North America? Have they reached North America and, in particular, us here in the Northeast?
Yeah, so Cyrex nictilio, that's the scientific name of the Cyrex wood wasp, did arrive in North America probably around the early 2000s, and most likely via wood packaging materials, so pallets, spools, that kind of thing. They were first detected in 2004 in northern New York, so pretty close to home.
Wow.
But within a couple of years, populations had been confirmed in a bunch of sites in northern New York and also over the border in Canada. And so since the mid-2000s, Cyrex wood wasp has been spreading in the Northeast and now is covers about 8 northeastern states, as far west as Michigan or so, and as far south as Pennsylvania. Although, you know, expect any day to hear of populations being found a little farther afield.
Mm. So what did your research attempt to do with the Cyrex?
So in our research, we were interested, well, first of all, in a really big question, which is just why species are invasive in some places and not in others. Mm. And the reason, so when Cyrex first arrived in North America, scientists and land managers were really interested in trying to understand what was going to happen here, because in the southern hemisphere, where Cyrex has gotten established as an invasive species, it's considered the number one most damaging pest in pine forests. And now in the southern hemisphere, pine forests are all plantations. Pines are native to the northern hemisphere. And so, you know, there are some different conditions in those southern hemisphere countries. But it was really concerning when they showed up. Generally, when we want to understand if a species is going to be invasive in a new place, a good thing to do is to compare what it does in its native range. In this case, we know that in the native range, Cyrex really has very limited impact. But in these other invasive, in the invasive range outside North America, the impact's really high. So we were interested in sort of three potential things that could be different between those places. One is just the food resources, the habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes differences in resource availability can cause a species to be invasive in a new place when it didn't cause problems elsewhere. Another thing is that presence of natural enemies or competitors, potentially. So those natural enemies that control populations, maybe they're different in a new place. And another thing that can vary is the life history traits, things like body size or the sex ratio. I mean, that's not something we see so much in mammals necessarily, but in insects, sex ratios can vary widely. So we wanted to understand what to expect as Cyrex continued spreading in North America. And we focused on their demography and worked to collect data that would let us calculate a kind of a simple number, which is the maximum number of new females that one wasp could produce in a year.
And you use these to determine what kind of growth we might see of the Cyrex wood wasp in North America?
Exactly. So that's an estimate of potential for population growth, all things being equal. So we collected a bunch of trees. We worked in Spain in the native range, and then in the northeastern U.S., in Vermont, New York, and Pennsylvania. And we found trees that had been attacked by the wasp. We cut them, put the logs into these big barrels with mesh on the front, and collected all the emerging insects. And then when they had all emerged from the logs, we dissected the logs and counted all the overposition sites. So we used those data to calculate the number of females produced per female per year. And the reason we focused on females is, as I mentioned before, the sex ratios can vary widely, and it's really new females that have the potential to go out and lay new eggs in new places.
Hmm. Laura, when we hear this term, invasive species, it makes us all shudder. But what does make a species invasive to a specific area, and why is that a bad thing?
Yeah, so invasive is an interesting term because there's some value. It's a little bit value-laden, right? So, yeah. You know, for species to be invasive, they need to arrive to a new place and then get established there, reproduce there, and then be able to expand their range. But then there's one more step that's really important, and that's that they cause negative impacts that we humans notice and care about. So these are usually economic, ecological, or potentially health impacts. There are a lot of species that are non-native and possibly widespread, but unless they cause those negative impacts, we don't tend to call them invasive.
Mm. All right. And are we seeing more of this invasiveness now because of global trade and climate change? Or has this always, you know, has there always been some level of this going on? Someone called in and mentioned lantern bugs. We're here.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? So.
The new pest knocking on the southern doorstep.
Right, right. So, you know, how is it more prevalent now, or has this always been going on?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, plants and animals and pathogens, too, have been moved around the world by people for a long time. But in recent decades, we really have seen super sustained high levels of introductions. And as long as there's, you know, the amount of global trade that's happening now, and potentially that will keep increasing, it's not going to stop. You know, I think when it comes to insects that have plants as hosts, as long as any kind of plants or plant materials are being moved around the world, they're going to keep arriving in new places from new places.
And, you know, I'm going to take the stand for the Cyrex. Is there any potential benefits to having this wood wasp here in the Northeast, here in Vermont?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't think anyone has ever asked me that before. So, I mean, when a species like the Cyrex wood wasp shows up in a new place, they do become a part of the community there. We also have some native wood wasps, even a native Cyrex species in the Northeast. We've actually looked a little bit to see if Cyrex is an important competitor and potentially harming that species at all, and there's not a lot of evidence that they are. So this might not exactly be a positive impact, but it could be that they join a new community and become a functioning part of the ecosystem. They also, they have mentioned before, they're considered more or less a scavenger in their native range, where they mostly attack sort of smaller, suppressed, weakened trees. So one could view that as a positive,
right,
if they're doing the job of thinning a stand.
That's right. Now, from your research, are the elements ripe for the Cyrex to really move in, set up shop here in the Northeast?
Yeah, so, you know, I love talking about this story because in some ways it's almost like a good news invasive species story, which we need more of those these days.
True.
So far we found that potential for populations to grow, that females per year, is about 3 times higher in North America than in Spain. And that was largely due to the fact that in the U.S., the average body size of Cyrex we found was larger than that in Spain. So in insects, body size is often really tightly correlated with the number of eggs that a female has. So larger females equals more eggs, more potential offspring. And then we also found that for some reason in North America, the nematodes are not able to enter the eggs inside a female's body. And so they're not actually functioning to sterilize those eggs. Whereas in Spain, about a third of female wasps have nematodes that are parasitizing them and are thus sterile. So even though they'll go out, lay eggs, spread those nematodes, there are no offspring that come out of that. So overall, when Cyrex finds good resources, there is this higher potential for population growth than in its native range that can happen in North America. But so far, that's probably been somewhat limited due to the really patchy distribution of pines in the Northeast. So listeners may be thinking, wait, we have a lot of pine trees. But interestingly, Cyrex doesn't really find our white pine to be a good host, and they don't really use it for reproducing. So they're using mainly red pine, mostly planted red pine stands, and also planted Scots pine stands. That's actually a non-native pine from Europe, but it was planted in some parts of the Northeast. So far, the news has been pretty good for our region.
Wow, because the first two things you mentioned there, it seemed like, oh my gosh, the potential for this spread is massive. But thank goodness they're just not that into our pines, and that's a good thing. And so we probably will not have to worry as much about the Cyrex wood wasp as we are right now about the emerald ash borer and the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Exactly. So in the Northeast, I'm certainly watching EAB carefully. And I mean, I have these two beautiful ash trees in the backyard that every year I look at them and I just hope that this isn't the year. For us in the Northeast, there's probably not a whole lot of concern about the Cyrex wood wasp. You know, landowners with older or overstocked pine stands could certainly see the wasp come through. You know, one thing to look for if you're curious is they create these really perfectly round emergence holes in a tree that they kill. And they're usually vary in size. So, I won't get into too much detail. But if anyone's curious, there are good resources online for diagnosing the signs of Cyrex mactylia infestation.
And what kind of impact, both environmentally, economically, could the Cyrex have in this country if it really did dig in?
Yeah, so our main concern is that when Cyrex reaches areas with more pine in the country, that things could change. For example, populations right now have reached southern Pennsylvania, maybe a bit further, and they're getting pretty close to the really extensive southern pine-growing region. So that's things like loblolly and longleaf. And there's the potential for a lot of economic damage there if we don't really know what outbreaks might look like. And some other ecosystems that we're interested in is the pitch pine ecosystems on the eastern seaboard, like New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts. There are a lot of natural red pine, jack pine forests in Michigan. And then, you know, one that I have my eye on is all the lodgepole pine out in the Mountain West, because we've found in some of our other research that lodgepole in the southern hemisphere in Argentina is extremely susceptible to attack.
Mm. So based on your research, what kind of likelihood would you say there is of such a massive invasion by the Cyrex wood wasp?
You know, I feel it's probably a matter of time before Cyrex shows up in new places.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somewhat hopeful that the native communities here will continue to help control populations. One thing I didn't mention before is the parasitoid wasps in North America. We have a native suite of them, and they control populations to a similar extent as those in the native range. Also, you know, pine trees do have some resistance to attack, but it's likely that we'll see some different outcomes when Cyrex is not so limited by resource availability like they are in the Northeast.
We've got to convince those nematodes that they got to get to work.
The nematodes, yeah, work, nematode training, that comes next.
I love it. Flora Krivec-Tetley is a postdoctoral researcher and an ecology, evolution, environment, and society lecturer at Dartmouth College. And Flora joined us this morning from Vancouver, B.C. So, Flora, thank you so much for that. It has been wonderful hearing about your research.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to talk to you.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to get some reminders on how to hunt wild turkeys safely. Coming up tonight at 7, we've got 2 great hours of jazz, as long as the game gets done by then. That's with George Thomas. Then it's Eye on the World with John Batchelor from 9 to 1. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The spring hunting season for wild turkeys in Vermont opens Sunday, runs through the entire month of May. But before you head out to bag some birds, I thought it would be wise to invite Vermont Fish and Wildlife Hunter Education Coordinator Nicole Meyer back on the show for a hunting safety refresher. Nicole, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Nicole, what kind of license will I need to hunt wild turkeys?
So that's a great question. You know, our youth and novice season just wrapped up last weekend. That's a special season just for brand new hunters or youth. So you don't need to worry about that. But what you will need to do is you'll need to buy a basic regular hunting license and make sure that you buy those turkey tags. Those are not a default tag that comes with your hunting license, so you do need to add those on. The other thing to think about is if you're interested in hunting turkeys, usually most turkeys are hunted with shotguns, firearms in Vermont. However, it is certainly legal to hunt turkeys with bows and crossbows. So if you want to do that, you don't need to get a special tag, but you do need to have a bow hunter education.
Okay. Now, how do you hunt for turkey? Do you have a stand like in deer season?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a tree stand is not going to do you much for turkey season. You certainly can use a tree stand if you want to, but turkeys, the main way that they are evading predators is through their outstanding sense of sight. Turkeys have fantastic eyesight. They're cued into little subtle movements, and changes in movement that's going on around them. So a tree fan's not going to do you a great deal of help, because generally tree fans are trying to get your scent up above and away from a deer.
Right.
As well as staying out of their line of sight. But generally what you're going to do is you're going to want to set up either in a ground blind or under some nice cover in the woods. And you're going to try to call in a gobbler, a bearded bird is what we're looking for. That's what's considered legal, is shooting a bearded bird. You're going to want to try to pretend to be a hen that is looking for a mate. So you're going to want to try to entice a turkey in that way.
And so you use a call. Can you do the call?
I do not have a call on me right now. But there are tons of really great and inexpensive calls, from mouse calls to box calls to push button calls and slate calls.
Yeah.
We actually just wrapped up a really great virtual series of workshops with National Wild Turkey Federation, and one of our videos was just how to call for turkeys. So you can check out our Facebook page or NWTF Vermont's Facebook page if you want to get some last-minute turkey calling tips in there.
Nice. And then how do I pick out, like, the proper place, the proper tree or rock to sit near to be hidden and yet still have a good shot at a wild turkey?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for me, site selection is not only about where the birds are, but where is the safest place to be sitting. So I like to sit in a spot that is pretty well covered, but at the same time gives me some really nice protection. So sitting with a tree or a big rock up against my neck and back, not only does that give me something to lean on, so I'm not just sitting upright the whole time that I'm sitting there in the woods, but if there is a hunter who hears me calling and maybe sees turkeys in my same line of sight, you know, their shot is not going to pose a threat to me because I have that large rock and large tree kind of covering my back. So that's really important. I mean, right now, turkeys are so abundant in Vermont, and in Vermont we have like a 30% success rate on hunting turkeys, which is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, really, right now we're seeing turkeys in a lot of the fields. They're coming out right now. You can see them gobbling and displaying. They're coming down from the roost right around sunrise. So now is a really great time to go check out the fields near your homes, by agricultural fields, and check out those turkeys and do some scouting for May 1st.
You said they have great eyesight. I'm all about fashion, so I want to dress properly for them. I mean, do I wear blaze orange, or, you know, what's the right colors, et cetera, to wear to go wild?
Great question. Home? Yeah, so when we're hunting turkeys, we really want to be camouflaged, but turkeys' eyesights are very cued in to that red, white, blue, and black. Red, white, and blue are the colors of a mating turkey's head. And black is kind of, their whole bodies are kind of look like a blackish color when we're out there hunting. We want to stay away from red, white, blue, and black. Stay away from those colors because that could possibly entice another hunter who is not as safe or as ethical as we are to come towards you. So stay away from those colors. Wear full camo. When you're walking into and out of your spot, I highly recommend wearing blaze orange, whether it be a hat or a vest or a backpack even, that might have some blaze orange on it. Wear that walking to and from your spot. And if you can, I also like to tie a little bit of bright orange flagging right above where I'm sitting, in a tree branch or something like that, so that other hunters can know that I'm there.
Now, if I get a turkey, and I, you know, is a third of a chance that I would, so, or you know, 33% basically.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I need to do in the field? Do I have to take it to a weigh station afterwards to report what happens?
Yeah, great question. So So the first thing you have to do is tag. Once you've confirmed that the turkey is dead, you tag the turkey. And you can do that either with those tags that you print off with your license or with those orange plasticky transportation tags. They hold up really well in the field. First thing you do is tag. And then you can either go to a weigh station to tag your turkey, and we have a list of all those weigh stations on our website, or you can go ahead and you can report your turkey online. Over the fall, I actually reported my false turkey on my phone. And that was a really great, cool thing to be able to do right there. And then I didn't even have to take it to the weigh station, although it's a lot of fun to show everyone that you've shot. It's if you've got to get right back to work, it's definitely a time saver to be able to report it online.
You mentioned we could use calls. Can we use decoys?
Yeah, absolutely. Decoys are a really fantastic way to try to entice turkeys towards you. You do have to be careful with your decoys. I try not to put a decoy right in front of me or where I am because, like I said earlier, there are people out there who are not as safe and not as ethical as us, and they might, especially if you have one of those really high-tech decoys, like an AvianX decoy or something like that, they might see it and think, oh, wow, there's my turkey, and it's standing really still, and take a shot. I mean, we're really lucky that in Vermont in 2021, we had zero hunting-related shooting incidents, despite something like 80,000 hunters being out in the field last year. So, I mean, we have a really fantastic safety record for hunting here in Vermont. I don't want to scare anyone, but I do want everyone to remain vigilant when they're in the woods so that 2022 can be an accident-free year as well.
Is there something I should do when I see another hunter?
Yeah, that's a great question. And many turkey hunters, especially those hunting on public lands, have run into other hunters. And I think that the best thing you can do is yell and just say, hey, there's a hunter here. Don't move first. First, yell and make your presence known, because sometimes people, there are, like I said, unsafe, unethical people who shoot at movement. That does happen. So make sure to just yell and say, hey, there's a hunter here. It's much better to screw up your hunt by possibly yelling and spooking some birds than it is to screw up your life by possibly being injured by another hunter.
You had a turkey in the fall, so how do these turkeys compare in size and taste to the domesticated birds that we have at Thanksgiving?
That's a really great question. You know, in general, they're not as fatty and they're not as plump. You know, those farm raised turkeys are have a pretty sweet gig, whereas our wild turkeys are constantly vigilant, on the run from predators, and you know, their natural lifespan is not as long as a turkey in captivity because of all of the pressures on them. I will say that wild turkeys, to me anyway, generally taste a lot more nutty. They're eating a lot more wild seeds and nuts and acorns and berries and bugs and stuff like that. So they do have a different taste. I would say it's more of a flavor than farm-raised birds, just because of the variety of their diet. And man, wild turkey is a delight to eat and cook, and it's a treasure, I think.
Nicole Meyer is a Vermont Fish and Wildlife Hunter Education Coordinator. And to learn more about the spring wild turkey season, you can go to vtfishandwildlife.com. Nicole, thanks for being on with us again.
Hey, yeah, absolutely. Shoot straight and hunt safe, okay?
All right, I will indeed. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Caregiving by a parent for an adult with disabilities is time-consuming and difficult work, but there is money available to pay for outside caregivers if you can get them. The state is looking at continuing a program that was instituted during the pandemic to help families in this situation, and here to tell us about it is Colin Flanders of 7 Days. Colin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What financial help do parents with adult disabled children receive from the state?
So there's a wide range of programs that the state offers. One of the main ones is that the state will either
fund local agencies will send caregivers directly into someone's home, or families can choose to receive a budget directly that they can then spend on caregivers themselves. So I talked to a few parents who receive a budget for their loved one and then decide how much money to pay the caregivers, what kind of caregivers they want to find. But there are also a handful of other programs, often overlapping. Everything with state government is pretty complicated. But the main ones are money set aside to help parents pay for caregivers to come into their homes and help them out for a certain number of hours each day.
How difficult is it to find that kind of caregiving help, even with the financial assistance?
From what I hear, it can be quite difficult. I talked to one mother who lives in Chittenden County, which is probably the easiest place to find caregivers. And she says that it can be quite difficult to not only find them, but keep them around. Usually she's lucky if they stick around a year. Just recently, she had two quit within a week or two span, one who just texted her her notice and then blocked her number. These are very reliable jobs. I think the main reason for that is that we're not able to pay these people a lot. Even the local agencies who are doing this in sort of a professional basis can only offer usually around $15 an hour. This is very physically and emotionally taxing work, and people get burnt out pretty quickly. And so it can be quite difficult to find these people around the state.
And, Colin, when that outside help isn't available, where does the responsibility fall?
The responsibility falls on the parents. And I think for parents out there, they might think, well, of course, they're parents, they should be doing this. But I think people have to understand that caring for, especially an adult with developmental disabilities, is a lot different than caring for a child without those disabilities. I mean, this can be very difficult work. And it is work. It is something that the state has identified as work. It's something we should pay for as a state, we should fund. And so parents are stepping in to provide this care, and it can be a lot on them. I mean, a couple people that I talked to just seemed at the end of their rope. They're struggling to get caregivers, and so they have to step in every day themselves and do this, and they have no backstop. It's not like they can run out and run an errand for a couple of hours and catch their breath. I mean, this is a full-time thing.
So the state has stepped up during the pandemic and paid parents directly. Can't the state just continue that, for the caregiving that they provide, since some of this money that, is going to be spent for that purpose anyway?
Yeah, so this is right now the state is considering whether to make this a permanent program, and it's a little more of a difficult conversation than just, well, if we have the money, shouldn't we do it? There are philosophical reasons why people think that the state would be better off putting its money elsewhere. And the main reason is that as a state, we want to be supporting people with developmental disabilities to be as independent as possible. We want to make sure that if they want to live outside of the home, if they want to go out on their own to the degree that they're able to, then we should be able to support them to do that. And that autonomy can sometimes it gets messy when we're paying parents, because not only is it the relationship that they have, the family relationship, but it turns into a economic relationship. And while a lot of people, the concern isn't as much that people will be viewing their loved ones as cash cow or anything like that, but it's more the idea that you might not be as willing to encourage your loved one to go branch out on their own when the money that's coming in is helping your family stay afloat. And so it really complicates the conversation.
Is it a lot of money? I know during the pandemic, as you mentioned, the parents were receiving money. Is it a lot? What were they getting? And is that provision still in effect right now?
Yeah, the provision is still in effect. The amount of money they were getting, in the grand scheme, isn't that much. So they were, each quarter, they were able to convert unspent funds in their care budgets into direct payments of up to $5,000. And so across a year, that's $20,000. And if you think of the amount of time that are spent caring for someone like this, it really quickly doesn't equal minimum wage. So I think that the conversation right now, not only about whether to continue this, but if we did, how, what would it look like? How much money would we pay parents? What would the safeguards be in place to make sure that these people are getting the services that they deserve? And how do we quality assurance check that? Is it going into people's homes, watching how they're caring for their children? Is it, how do you even differentiate between paid care and unpaid care? Because like I said, this is a nonstop thing that people are doing. And so it's a lot of things have to be worked out still.
You mentioned one of the reasons people would be against paying parents in this situation was the philosophical idea of, that child not leaving the home, not branching out. But I think there's people, too, who worry about its effect on the paid caregivers, the outside caregivers, and, whether or not you're basically cutting them out of jobs.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a big question as we're talking about how much would parents be paid? Where would that money be coming from? I mean, it has to come from somewhere. And so there is a concern that if we're directing a lot more money towards parents, that will mean perhaps less money for the local agencies that rely on government funding and do provide very important services. I talked to one advocate, and the way that she put it is that she fears that codifying this practice will enable the state to continue shortchanging these local agencies. And if we were to offer parents the same lousy pay that we offer professional caregivers, then we will just continue to undermine the system and not deliver on the promises that we make to people, the promises of the services that we need to provide. And so there is a lot to consider about whether to make this a permanent thing. But from the parents' perspective, what they say is they are already providing this free labor for the state because a lot of this money does sometimes go unspent. And so there are definitely strong arguments on either side.
Are there ample opportunities for the disabled adults to live independently outside their parents' home in Vermont?
Yeah, so that's another major pressure here is that there are few alternatives that exist for people who want to live outside their family homes. Beyond several dozen group homes or staff residential centers, the only option is really what's known as shared living, and that's in which the state pays someone a salary to live with and support a person with developmental disabilities. There's about 1,400 adults who receive shared living arrangements right now. But parents sort of can resent the idea of sending their grown child to live in a stranger's house. Some refer to it as adult foster care. And even more troubling is that a lot of these people are burning out. I talked to one local agency in Colchester, and they said they have 8 people right now who are living in situations that are pretty precarious because either their shared living provider is on the verge of quitting or their parents are aging out, and they don't really know where to put these people. And so the idea of maybe if we can pay some parents to help stabilize the homes, maybe it makes sense. So that is a major concern with the lack of residential options otherwise.
So who makes the decision if this idea of continuing to pay the parents as caregivers is to continue? How does it, get done? Is it the legislature? Is it a state agency?
Yeah, so the Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, or DALE, mm-hmm. is currently working on a multi-year plan that spells out how we deliver these services in Vermont. And they say that this is one of their top focuses, deciding whether to continue this. If they do decide to continue this, they will make the decision. But then they have to go to the federal government and ask for permission because currently the federal government does not allow this. But states have been able to negotiate it. And so I think there is a thinking if we do as a state decide to move forward, we probably will be able to get permission from the federal government. But there's a lot of things that need to fall into place. They're hoping to make the decision by the fall. So we'll have to see.
And we only have about 30 seconds left, but how many parents have received money during the pandemic to be the caregivers in these situations?
Yeah, so the state doesn't have firm data on this because of the way that they are collecting how many payments are made and how much money was spent. But I was told that we sent out about 1,200 payments during the pandemic, and that's if you average that out over 8 quarters, that's about 200, but a lot of families didn't get every payment. So my best guess is a few hundred at least. But I think more and more parents might be interested in it if the wages were higher or if it was easier. I think the demand is something we'll have to figure out.
Mm-hmm. You can read Colin's story in this week's edition of 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Colin, thanks so much for filling us in on this.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll be back to meet Mark Kelly, who just keeps doing the same thing over and over again, and it's pretty darn impressive. And coming up today, 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. That's followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Catella and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, isn't highly recommended. But what if you did the same thing over and over again, because you want pretty much the same results? There's something to be said for that. One Vermonter has been hiking the same two mountains for about a decade, and he loves what he does, what it does for him. Mark Kelly has hiked up Camel's Hump and Mount Mansfield approaching 2,000 times, and he joins us to explain why. Mark, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Great having you. To ask Mark about his incredible feats of redundancy that he's accomplished with his feet, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, have you always been someone who's enjoyed the outdoors and hiking?
I have. Yeah, I came by that very early in my life because my family had a house. Well, actually, a relative had a house up in the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go there every summer for the better part of 2 months, from about 6 years old till I was about 18. So we'd have this great outdoor playland that we could just open the door in the morning, go out and play all day long, climb Slide Mountain. There were rivers, there were streams, over 750 acres. My uncle was a caretaker on this estate that he took care of in the summertime, and that was pretty much our summer haunt.
What a backyard.
It didn't get any better.
Oh, that's fabulous. So what got you started hiking up Mansfield and Camel's Hump about 10 years ago?
It started in 2012 when I was 48 years old, and I came to the realization I was the same age that my mother had passed away at. She was 48. My job at the time really wasn't giving me what I needed, and I had just come out of a long-term relationship, and I was just trying to ascertain what my next steps were. I was a little bit of a rut. I was on Mansfield one morning. It was in early July. I'd already done about 20 that year on Mansfield, which was a pretty normal year at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know what? Before the end of this year, I'm going to do 100 on Mansfield. I'm going to do it specifically on this trail, which was the Sunset Ridge Trail. And I was like, just before the end of the calendar year, I'm just going to bang out 100. And that's how this all began. I really didn't have any plans beyond that. I wasn't thinking like this is something I'm going to do for the rest of my life, or I'm going to do this continually next year and on. And it just every year it sort of evolved from there.
So you hit the 100 before the end of the year?
I hit the 100 in, I think, late November, early December. I think I finished up with like 105, 106 that year. And then all of a sudden I just decided, hey, you know, this is what I want to do. And then at the time I just sort of had 100 as a goal, and every year it's just sort of grown from there, evolved. And now it's just taken on a life of its own.
How has doing these hikes up Mansfield and Camel's Hump helped you?
It's helped me every way conceivable. It's helped me mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. You know, when I started doing this, a lot of it was I was kind of leaving baggage on the mountain and then coming home feeling, I guess, more refreshed, more aware of my surroundings. Now it's interesting. I don't really leave baggage as much anymore. I'm more completely in the moment on the mountain, and I feel that I'm aware of everything that's transpiring inside me, outside me, weather, animal interactions, people interactions. It checks off every box for me.
And just so people understand, that was figurative baggage. He didn't actually take – he wasn't like downsizing and taking like old clothes
no.
and leaving them up.
I'm a big believer in leave no trace.
Well done. Well done, Mark. Yeah, what solace do you get from hiking these two mountains in particular?
You know, what I realized was that I did not need to see new peaks to get what I needed out of it. It's really more about – it's actually all of it. I love the drive there. Mm-hmm. I love the drive back, because in the drive there, it's anticipatory, excited for the hike. On the drive back, I'm processing the hike and just sort of living in that moment, and then I can transition to my life when I get back. But then the mountains themselves – it's what I get from it. It's not like I need it to be new every time. But what's on the flip side of that, it is new every time.
Right.
Because every time I go, I'm different. I'm not the same person. And then, of course, it's just every time the trail's different, I notice something new. The experiences are different. Animal interactions. The weather is different. The trail itself has physically changed. And I just, for me, having them basically equidistant from my house in Burlington, you know, I do Mansfield spring, summer, fall, mm-hmm. and I do Cantalus up all through the winter. And that's much transition and newness that I really need. No, don't get me wrong. If I am somewhere else and there's a mountain, I'm going to go on a hike it.
Gotcha.
But I don't feel the need to drive further afield to kind of like check off those boxes.
You don't feel like you're cheating on your two mountains if – if there's a mountain nearby and you
I do not. No, they will cut me some slack.
So how often do you get out and hike?
Now my average is up to about 170 times a year.
Wow. So you had that goal back in the day to do 100.
Yep.
You're doing about 170 a year. So in this decade of these hikes,
yep.
The last story I saw had you about 1,700. Where do you think you are right now?
I know exactly where I am because I journal every one of my hikes, single one of them. So I'm at 1,808.
Okay. But you did not go up today.
I did not. We are in the middle of mud season. So mm-hmm. my two mountains right now are off limits. It's basically any mountain above 2,000 feet because we don't want to do anything to decimate the trails and help the erosion problem, so I'm staying off of them.
All right, so 1808 right now, that's pretty phenomenal. And when you go to these two mountains, do you always hike the same trails, or do you vary that?
I do. I go to Mansfield at Underhill State Park, and my two trails there are the Sunset Ridge Trail or the Laura Cowles Trail, and then I go to Camelson from the Huntington side, and I'm mm-hmm. on the Burroughs Trail.
So you are Mr. Consistency.
I try to be. Yeah.
And is that something that gives you a certain amount of structure or something that, you know, that you said you enjoy everything about it, the drive there, those particular hikes. But, I mean, you know, some people might say, come on, dude, you know, is there a certain solace that you find in being consistent in following this kind of routine?
Tremendously so. And that's part of the reason why sometimes I get amused when anybody asks me, like, don't you get bored? Why don't you branch out? Why don't you try other hikes? And, you know, that's great if that is your thing. But I've understood for myself that I don't need to do that to get what I need from it. So, no, I love the consistency piece. And it allows me – I mean, I know almost like every rock, every, you know, route. I can almost do a blindfolded. So it lets me transport my brain and my mind and my emotional self to kind of just being in the surroundings.
And what about times of day? Are you pretty consistent with that as well or not?
Yeah, more often than not, I really appreciate the early mornings.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, it's much less crowded.
Right.
And I am an early morning person, and I love that. I love having the trail to myself as much as possible.
Yeah.
It's a solace thing.
Yeah. Always solo or?
Always solo. Every once in a blue moon, I will have either my girlfriend join me for a few hikes a year or my brothers join me for a few of my milestones, like 100 here or 100 there.
Oh, nice.
You know, it's great because he'll come and he'll bring a couple beers for us to sit on top of the mountain and have a beer to celebrate it. And then we'll go out for breakfast afterwards. And the same thing with my girlfriend. We've done the same similar thing.
I'm looking at 1808. So you probably will hit 2,000 this year.
I won't hit it this year.
Oh, no, it'll be
I won't hit it this year, but I will definitely hit it next year.
And so you're going to have somebody special or do something
special? I think
next
year the 2,000 will be a big one.
Yeah.
So I might try to bring both my girlfriend and my brother and root for that one.
That would be fantastic. All right. And are they casual hikes or are you really moving up and down the mountain?
I would say there's nothing casual about them. I'm moving at a good clip. I have a way that I do it. I'm an ultimate minimalist. The only things I bring with me, I bring my smartphone and I bring my car key. That's it. I don't bring anything else. There's no water. There's no food. I do that all on the ride there and then on the ride back.
Sure.
And the fact that I hit it really hard, so I'm up and down very quickly. So I don't get dehydrated. I don't – and I'm not espousing that for anybody else.
Right.
That is just what works best for me. But it has evolved. I no longer time myself. You know, I used to time myself for all my hikes to see how fast I could do it.
Yeah,
and I've hit some pretty great milestones for myself. But now I don't do that anymore because I know as I'm getting older and I want to continue this for as long as humanly possible. And to time yourself sometimes, you have to take some risks.
Right.
And I've taken some pretty quality falls and stumbles and had all kinds of banged up knees and broken fingers and all kinds of good stuff.
Anything that kept you out of commission long enough where you couldn't get to it?
Nope. I mean, I am stubborn. Anybody that knows me will tell you that I am stubborn. And if I'm not feeling 100%, I will still go and I will just kind of adjust my pace accordingly.
It's funny you kind of described the first time I ever did Camel's Hump. I just pulled in and I thought, I'll walk to the top,
sure.
Right? And, you know, I moved at a healthy clip. I had nothing with me. Same thing, probably a cell phone, car keys, wallet, you know. And people had backpacks and stopping for lunches. I'm thinking, maybe I should have done a little more preparation. But you can get here to there and it's not a problem, is it?
My philosophy is there's no one right way.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to deck yourself out and get going to like an excursion to Everest, God bless you. I mean, I don't care.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to do their own thing. But for me, just going as light as possible and really pretty quickly is what works best for me.
Wow. All right. Mark, tell us about what you do with the Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired, or as you call it for short, VABV.
Primarily, I am a driver for a TVI, which is a teacher for the visually impaired, and she herself is legally blind.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my number one function, transporting her to and from schools, from students' homes, any other place they may need to be. And, of course, I do other things around the association, whatever tasks they might throw my way.
Tell me about the association itself and the work they do.
They're based – well, there are, my home office is based in South Burlington. We also have satellite offices in Rutland and down in the Montpelier area. And basically they service anywhere from infants to senior citizens, and they have different divisions. They have an adult division and the, you know, student division. I work with – a teacher who works with children and students up to high school age.
Mm-hmm. And you drive, but what other services are available through VABV?
Oh, wow. I mean, they provide all kinds of adult learning going into home visits. They will accompany clients to doctor's appointments. They will go into schools. They will advocate anything to help this clientele that is – I wouldn't say underserved, but need all services they can get.
Absolutely. Now, you've done these hikes, 1,808 of them. Have you ever used your numerous hikes as a way to raise money for an organization? Or is this just you hiking every single –
You know, that's a great question. I have not, and it's something I probably should consider in the future. But, no, this has always just been my thing, my passion.
Yeah. All right. Let's take – it's the great Rusty DeWeese joining us this morning. Hi, Rusty.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for taking my call, Rick. And by the way, just for your information, the Waterbury Center shows were full houses each night. So
love to hear it. Fantastic.
Love the guest. I do the same thing, sir. I've never heard about too many people not, you know, doing the water before and after. And I just hike with my cell phone and my key. But I do have some specific questions. And I bet you have the answers. How long up, minutes-wise, and how long down when you do Mansfield from Underhill, and how long up and how long down on your Camel's Hump? Also, what is the top level you get your heart that you get your heart rate to on either one of them?
Okay, good question.
That's about it.
Thanks, Rusty.
My record for Mansfield on Laura Cowles is I've done it in under an hour round trip. And on Sunset Ridge, I've done it round trip in about an hour and 8 minutes. And then on Camel's Hump on the Burroughs Trail, once again, I've done it in just right around an hour round trip. I do not check my heart rate. I am definitely a techno idiot. I don't keep track of any of that stuff, honestly. The only thing I ever look at the end is I look at my cell phone to see, you know, what my step count was, the amount of floors that I gained, things along those lines.
Yeah.
But other than that, I honestly don't track it. And I no longer time myself, like I said.
Now, as Rusty mentioned, you don't take a lot with you.
Yeah.
You don't dress particularly warm or heavy either.
No, I don't at all.
How do you dress to do these?
Well, I basically will go in either just like a really light pair of like athletic pants or shorts, depending on the time of season. Up top, I'll have like a T-shirt and like what I'm wearing today, like a Patagonia top, and then just a very lightweight shell, because the last thing I want to do is overheat. I'm much more concerned about overheating than I am about being cold, especially the pace that I'm moving at.
Even in the coldest days?
Even in the coldest days, absolutely. I mean, I might add like a warmer pair of gloves or mittens or my like warmest hat, but that's about – or like a good base layer for my legs. But other than that, that's pretty much the extent that I will go.
And then the footwear?
Footwear for me is everything. And for me, I want it to be as light as possible, as flexible as possible, so I get the most ground and rock feel. Because I want to be able to feel everything. I don't want something that's really stiff and heavy where I don't feel like I'm in the control, especially at the pace I'm moving and the way I hit rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll take a few bone bruises, something along those lines. I'm okay with that, but you know, let me feel the surface that I'm standing on.
My feet are saying, ouch.
I mean, what I'm actually wearing today is what I wear on the mountain. This is what I wear.
Oh, there they are.
Yeah.
How about that? And I understand you go through a couple of those a season.
Bare minimum is two. It's probably more like 2 to 3 pair a season.
Yeah. All right. Now, you know, have you gotten to know any other people who do hikes regularly as you're doing this?
I do. And what's really kind of cool about it is I have like separate groups of friends on both mountains. Some people I only see on Camel Ascent, some people I only see on Mansfield.
Yeah.
And now I'm also in this hiking in Vermont group on Facebook, and I connect with a lot of those folks on the trail as well. And I've met some of the folks at the Green Mountain Club as well. So I do have quite the like hiking family that I love to see on the trail.
Oh, that's
so
with
a Dave
cool.
Brightner.
Yeah, that is a Dave Brightner. And we've talked about it's the two mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, if you're somewhere else,
yes,
you'll do another mountain.
Correct.
But you don't break from this routine when you're local, right? These are the two.
I don't at all.
Yeah.
I pretty much stick completely to that. And this is my 11th year of doing that.
Oh, man. And Mount Musilak is crying. this feels very Cal Ripken-esque, you know. But
great reference.
Yeah. But he had Lou Gehrig's record, you know, to kind of chase, right, that Iron Man streak. Do you have any ultimate goals with this hiking?
You know, I candidly don't. I'm going to keep doing this the way that I'm doing it as long as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's going to continue to evolve. There might be times when I have to, you know, cut back a little bit or whatever the case may be, whether it be from work or life related. But no, I'm just going to keep doing this until I can't do it anymore.
And bone bruises, bad days, you know, the weather looks a little crappy. You don't care.
Couldn't care less.
No kidding.
Some of my absolute favorite days are the days when the weather's the most extreme, because I know more often than not that I'm not really going to see anybody, and I feel like I'm getting one over on the world.
Yeah,
because this, you know, I go there's days when it's 30 below zero with the wind chill like minus 50, 60. I look forward to it. I love it.
And it's not just the physical benefits. You look like you're in great shape, but it really is how it helps you psychologically.
Tremendously so. It's meditative. It's cathartic. I can't even begin to ascribe what it means for me to be out in that environment. And in the world we're living in that's so hectic and so crazy, to be able to go to a space like that and sometimes have it completely to yourself,
yeah,
what could be better than that?
Yeah, it's why we live here.
It is why we live here.
Yeah, great point. Do you have any other hobbies that you give even half as – that you get as even half as much pleasure out of as hiking these two hills?
I have other hobbies, but there's nothing that connects me to the world and our surroundings like this. I mean, I love to read. I love crosswording.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, but no, there's nothing like this.
Wow, fantastic. Do we have another call? It looks like we might not be able to get that in. Is there a new book I just picked up yesterday? I think it's called Puzzling. I'm going to have to let you know about it. I think it might
Please
be
do.
One you'll enjoy. Mark Kelly drives for the Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. He has climbed Mount Mansfield and Camel's Hump 1,808 times. Mark, I want to thank you so much for sharing these accomplishments with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Rick. My pleasure.
You should be very proud of what you're doing. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. And listeners, feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayers up next. I'm Rick Zingari. Tomorrow morning, back on the road. This time I hit Waterbury. The Cabot Farmers store on Route 100 will be opening at 9, so you can go shop early for cheese. We'll be broadcasting live, surrounded by all that wonderful cheddar.